rectangular expanses of intense color float upon the canvas. Their blurred edges make the colors appear to vibrate with a magical quality. That can only be a description of a painting by Mark Rothko, one of the most famous and influential post-war American artists. Christopher Rothko, a writer and psychologist, chairs the board of directors of the Rothko Chapel in Houston, organizes and presents exhibitions of his father's work around the world. His new book of essays, titled Mark Rothko, From the Inside Out, is part memoir, part art criticism. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm pleased it has brought Christopher Rothko to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Your father died when you were only 6 years old. What do you remember about him?
I have some very concrete memories from a young age. But
do you go to his studio while he was working?
I did when I was young. I did spend a fair bit of time in there, but I never saw him paint. He was very private that way. Even when he had assistants late in his career, they would help him prepare canvases and paints, and then they would leave. And painting was always a solitary activity for him.
It got more difficult later after he'd had a heart attack.
Yes, he had a heart attack and an aneurysm. That's right. And
on ladders, and that wasn't so easy.
Yeah, the last few years of his life, he was restricted by doctors to painting on a very small scale and just on paper. And he actually worked furiously during that time and produced the largest number of works of any time in his career. And at a certain point, about a year and a half after that aneurysm, he just decided to say, I don't care what the doctor says. And he started painting on a larger scale and back on canvas, and he just was not going to let a condition stop his passion.
Was it odd researching your own father's life? Because much of the story was before you were born.
Yes, I guess in a sense it's not so much a research project because it's not particularly about the life. It is really, it's almost entirely about the work. And from my perspective, and this is really part of the title of the book, the Inside Out part, if you're looking too much at the life, you're going to miss the work. And it's really about concentrating on the painting and having a direct conversation with that painting. Otherwise, you're not going to really meet Rothko. You're going to meet some effigy of him, but the man's in the work.
So it doesn't matter that he grew up in Latvia or that he dropped out of Yale or that he didn't really study art formally?
All those things matter in making him the person that he was and bringing him to the place that he got to, but I don't think it particularly matters for the viewer in terms of having that kind of direct experience with the painting.
Should we think about who his early influences were? Clay, Rouault, Milton Avery?
Yes, and Milton Avery was a particularly strong influence and also really kept my father from starving during the Depression, so forever grateful to the Averys. But yes, he was deeply influenced by Matisse also in the 20th century, but also loved art history and loved the old masters, particularly Rembrandt, Giotto, and he drew a lot of his energy from them. Never saw himself as a revolutionary, saw himself as continuing their tradition.
Started out as a figurative painter,
yes,
as most artists do. Most abstract artists originally paint figures and then have to make a decision somewhere along the line whether they're going to abandon the figures. He's often called an abstract expressionist, but he doesn't look like the other abstract expressionists. Should we call him that?
Most artists
nothing
don't
like De Kooning or Pollock or artists of that sort.
I don't think any artist wants to be put in a box or an ism. That said, it's not an accurate description because his work is clearly abstract. His most classic work is clearly abstract. Even his earlier work, the figurative work, it's never a portrait of a person you're going to get to know. It's describing a feeling. It's describing a situation or a human condition rather than a concrete person or a concrete moment.
He created an intriguing series of paintings made in the New York City subways in the 1930s that showed these frail figures leaning on the pillars, those metal pillars in the subway stations. Are those works displayed much today?
You see a fair number of those works in any retrospective of my father's work. There will always be a couple rooms of the early work, and there have been exhibitions that focus just on his figurative work, both at museums and in galleries. They are, they're incredibly instructive in terms of seeing where the abstract work comes from, but they have a really a beauty of their own, and again, they have that remarkably abstract quality for a figurative painter.
Didn't he stop painting for a year in order to study philosophy?
He did.
Is that reflected in the work?
I've always thought of him as less a painter and more of a philosopher who painted. He was really about the ideas, and he did stop for a year or so and was studying Greek myth, was studying philosophy, and wrote his own or a portion of a book of his own philosophy of art.
When I studied art in London, some of the abstract painters told me that they were most influenced by Rothko because he was an abstract painter whose painting dealt with ideas. And I guess they got it. It's interesting that a lot of people here didn't get it, although how long did it take before the paintings that we associate with him gained the kind of recognition made him famous?
There was sort of this magical moment for the whole New Yorker abstract expressionist school right around 1950. Pollock became known maybe a year or two before that, but really that whole school of painters, there was a sudden excitement in sort of post-war America, and all of a sudden, America was the art scene. And so it was around 1950 he first started gaining recognition, but in all honesty, he couldn't support himself just painting until into the 1960s.
He was teaching
in
San Francisco, and then he was at Brooklyn College. Didn't get tenure in Brooklyn College, but he, I took a class with him in graduate school not long before he died.
Oh,
so he was at Hunter College.
At Hunter College, yes. He taught one term there.
So why do you think that his palette changed over the years from those bright painted colors that we associate with his classic period into something darker?
I think the primary reason for the change that happened in the late 50s, after he had in fact gained a good bit of recognition, I think he worried that he was making it a little too easy for people to appreciate his work, that the colors were too seductive, and that maybe they were missing some of those ideas we were talking about. And I think he wanted people to not have this sort of immediate reaction and instead have a slower, more considered relationship with the paintings. And I do also want to caution, because while there is definitely a trend towards darker works, there are many brightly colored works, even in the latest point of the career.
For people who don't get abstract painting, even though it's been around for 100 years now, what were the ideas?
Well, I first of all like that you mentioned that people still struggle with this. These paintings are 50, 60 years old, and they still feel very modern in some ways. And I think
some people will sit and stare at them and get totally enmeshed in them, practically really connect, almost have mystical experiences. And then others will say, and walk by.
Absolutely. And I think the key is in that word experience. These are paintings that don't have an idea written on a billboard that you come and just take away. It is really a meeting between viewer and painter. My father was certainly very involved with existential questions. Really, what does it mean to be alive? What is our human experience? He had ideas about that were both specific on some level, but also more generalized that he put into his paintings. But you have to bring your sense of that and have a direct experience of the painting to make your own sense of them.
My guest is Christopher Rothko, who's written a book called Mark Rothko, From the Inside Out. You're a psychologist?
I am, although I have not practiced in quite a few years.
Although you approach your father's work as a son, I see the psychologist here. How does that work in looking at your father's work?
There's no question I look at them psychologically, and I really think of them as a type of almost emotional barometer sometimes. I will walk past a Rothko work that I've always loved, and one day it doesn't move me. That might happen for a week or two, and then I come back and it has that same kind of power that it did before. And of course the painting hasn't changed. I'm seeing it in the same place and essentially the same lighting, more or less the same time of day. And they're really uncanny in terms of how they evoke feelings and moods from us, and they tell us what's going on with us, because we're of course the ones who are changing.
He employed multiple layers of paint, used oils to the end.
Acrylics in the last couple of years, but up to that point, strictly oils. Well, that's not true. He made his own home brew, is the truth of the matter, but
to
largely
keep it almost transparent.
Mm-hmm,
that some painters felt that was a mistake because it makes the surface more vulnerable.
They are, it depends on the work, but they are often very thinly painted. It's the canvas is almost stained sometimes, that there'll be layers and layers of paint that's been thinned with so much turpentine that it's really stain upon stain. The vulnerability, I think, as much as anything, comes from the fact that, you know, with big expanses of color, there's very little room for damage to hide.
Why did he stop giving his paintings titles?
I actually have an essay in the book called Untitled, and to my mind, with the exception of Homage to Matisse from 1946 on, they are all untitled.
Not even numbered, like some abstract artists did.
Well, some of them are numbered, but they were really numbered just for convenience sake in exhibitions, and I doubt that he even applied the numbers himself. In fact, I know for at least two exhibitions my mother was the one who numbered them. Again, he doesn't want to dictate your experience in any way. He really wants you to go and bring wide open eyes and an unbiased mind to that interaction. And even the suggestion of a title, even the color titles you sometimes see, already skewing your approach to the painting.
As I mentioned, I studied with your father very shortly before his death. He seemed to the students in the class to be rather depressed, and we were worried about him. Why do you think the public is so fascinated by the fact that this very great artist, who was still in the peak of his powers, committed suicide?
Well, I have an essay about his suicide in the book called Van Gogh's Ear, and it's as much about the phenomenon of suicide as it is about his, which is to say that suicide is one of those things that's so unimaginable, so forbidden in our minds, but it's one of those things that's it's attractive and how frightening it is to us. It's the type of thing that we it's so frightening, we need to make sense of it. So in that sense, it becomes, I think, a magnet for people's attention in terms of my father, and also a distraction in terms of how they view the work.
Even Dar Williams even wrote a song about it. How accurate did you feel John Logan's Tony Award-winning 2010 play Red was?
I think it didn't attempt to be accurate. I think it was a piece of theater. It was a very compelling hour and 20 minutes of basically a discussion of philosophy of art, which I thought was a small miracle, that people could find something that compelling that's really quite abstract and philosophical for an hour and 20 minutes. He gets the story of the Seagram Commission actually quite accurate in terms of who my father was, the relationship with his assistant, who did not quite exist in that sense. It's a lot of a poetic license.
The Seagram Commission, because he was commissioned by the Four Seasons restaurant to paint a series of paintings, and then he was horrified when he realized who was going to be sitting in the room with those paintings.
Yes, I think my father, frankly, deceived himself. It was his first big public commission. And he, I think, was very excited about the fact that he would be able to paint works for a room that only his works would be in and really be able to control the whole atmosphere. And there are various versions of the story, but ultimately my father was not facing the reality of his paintings in a private dining room. And when he finally did realize that he was going to be competing with Bourguignon and you know, good Bordeaux, he decided that he was going to lose that battle, and he got out.
And he said he intended to paint something that will ruin the appetite of every son of a bitch who ever eats in that room.
Yes, that was the famous quote. I think, frankly, that was a bitterness after the fact just before he withdrew, bitterness that he had led himself down this path and now was having to let go of something that was had been so appealing to him.
Houston is a city that's very proud of all of the abstract art that it has, but perhaps the most famous place is the Rothko Chapel. Can you tell us a bit about that? He was commissioned to do those paintings?
Yes, he was commissioned by John and Dominique de Menil, who were art collectors, but really just visionaries in terms of culture, rewrote the cultural map of Houston. But they were also deeply spiritual people and wanted to create a place of worship, but one that was not going to put people into traditional boxes, with all the separations between who could come there and what faith meant. They wanted a place that was engaged people more broadly, a much broader spectrum people. The chapel is completely ecumenical. But in addition, they saw modern art as a way of making a spiritual connection to a whole new generation of people who might not be moved by a crucifix or a traditional painting of Christian art. They were deeply Catholic people. people themselves.
And you have these very dark paintings in very sunny Houston.
Indeed. It's a very sudden adjustment that you make. You walk into the chapel from this very noisy, active, and brilliantly lit place to a room that is quiet, preferably empty, but also quite dark. And you need to spend a few minutes to even adjust to the light and then the whole atmosphere, which is really a very different place from the rest of Houston.
We have very little time, but the last essay in your book is about your mother, who died shortly after your father died. They had been separated at the end?
Yes, my parents separated about a year before my mother
died.
But
he dedicated one of his greatest paintings to her, Slow Swirl at the Edge of the Sea.
He did. That was and that painting hangs at MoMA all the time, and it's subtitled Mel. That was her nickname, Mel Ecstatic. They had a very passionate romance, and even though they separated, they remained quite close. He called her every day that year that he was living away.
Did he help her? Did she help him with his art?
I don't believe so. Again, he was very private about
his art.
Wouldn't
let you see him paint.
Just it was his solitary journey.
There's currently a retrospective exhibit of your father's paintings on display through January 24th at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. Will it be coming to New York?
No. Houston is the final stop. So go see it before January 20th.
And Christopher Rothko's book is Mark Rothko from the Inside Out. It is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.